All right. We are in Shoftim Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, dealing with the story of Yiftach. We introduced Yiftach. We noted the split in terms of different approaches to his identity, in the sense that on the one hand, he's a shofet. He's one of the leaders, and the assumption is that the shoftim are righteous, Avimelech being, you know, a problem. But generally speaking, that's the way that we look at them. And we read the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, which says that he has the same halachic authority in his time as Shmuel has in his day, and that has to count for something. We're going to see today the Chida, who renders him as great. On the other hand, the other way to read that Gemara in Rosh Hashanah is that he's not so great. He's called among the Kalei Olam, the world lightweights, the global lightweights. And we saw another Gemara that talked about how empty people gathered to him because he was empty, and like attracts like. And we saw the Medrash Tanchuma that says that what happens with his daughter is because he is not a Ben Torah, he doesn't know how to take a proper vow. And we saw the Medrash about his refusal to go to Pinchas to get the vow repeated. So you really have a split on how to read Yiftach, and I didn't really mention it last week, but you always have the sort of standard problem when you read about anybody in Tanakh being cast in a negative light of, is this meant to be like I can look at them as being negative, or is it like, well, on the level they were on, you know, for them, they did not live up to what they should have been. Yeah, and that's a classic question whenever you read about people in Tanakh. So that's an open question, and it's going to run through the entire story. We gave also the Dat Mikra's introduction to the Yiftach phenomenon, the idea of the outcast who lives outside of the community and has a group of people who band together around him, and then the community seeks their help when the community has a particular need, and that's something that we're going to revisit now. We read the opening few psukim of Perek Yud Aleph, the opening three verses, last time, and we asked a bunch of questions which we now have to approach. We began by saying that Yiftach is a gibor chayil, and that term is often a positive term. Chayil itself is, of course, associated with Rus, the Eshes Chayil that she is, and then that is used for the ideal in the end of Sefer Mishlei, of Proverbs. And the idea of being Gibor doesn't have to be good. Gibor can be a neutral trait. It just means that somebody is powerful. Nimrod is a Gibor Tzayid Lifnei Hashem, and according to most, although not all, according to most, Nimrod's a bad guy. So Gibor does not necessarily have to mean that he's good. Nonetheless, take a look at what I brought you in source number one from the Chida. This is the Chida who I mentioned earlier. The Chida is Rav Chaim Yosef David Azulai. He wrote a commentary which is called Chomat Anach, which I am not normally in the habit of quoting. I think I quoted it earlier, once before already in Shoftim. I don't normally do. He's very drash oriented. It doesn't really fit in terms of the close read of the psukim of the verses. But I thought it was worth seeing what he says here. He says Ve'efshar Lomar. He says one could say Ki Yiftach Gibor Chayil, that Yiftach was a Gibor Chayil, which I translated as a mighty person, because there are too many other ways you can translate Gibor Chayil. Ve'im kol zeh Hishpil atzmo V'lo asashum machlokes V'lo bilbul. But you know what? When they kicked him out, he took it. He lowered himself. He didn't make a fight. He didn't start a fuss. V'nidcha mipnei hasha'a U'barach mipnei achav. He was pushed away literally because of the time, meaning the moment was lost, and he fled from his brothers. He's actually, you know what, let me hold off on the rest of his comment, because it'll make more sense in a minute, or in a few minutes. But he reads this statement that he's a Gibor Chayo as a positive statement about Yiftach, that even though he could have started a fight, he chose not to. You don't want me? Fine. I'll go there. I'll go. I'll leave the community because they're not interested in me. So
when he uses the word hishmir atzmo, that's not a negative.
No, it's a positive.
Yeah.
Correct. In the same way that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says one should be shfal ruach, right, of humble spirit. That's the idea. If you jump to the end actually of number one. the last several words. Bo ure kama zariz v'niskar boreach mehamachlokes. See how he was energetic and rewarded, and he fled strife. He didn't want to fight with people. What the reward was, we'll talk about.
Was he rewarded for fleeing strife? Because it sounds like he...
Oh. Yeah, that's the idea. The language is a little bit awkward, but yes, I think that's what he's saying. So before we get to the rest of what he talks about, the rest of it is going to be based on this issue of the place to which he fled, this Eretz Tov. But before we get to that, we are also told that he is a Ben Isha Zona. So we talked about that a little bit, very little bit, last time. Radak brings you four different approaches to how to understand the word Zona in this context and what the origin of each view is. So, you know, usually when we think of the word zona, usually we understand that it reflects promiscuity. That's the usual understanding, and somebody who's dedicated to that. But that's not the first approach he brings. Ben Pilegesh Gilad Haya. He was the son of Gilad's concubine. Now remember, concubine is not something that's promiscuous. Concubine is a monogamous relationship. It simply lacks the formal halachic structure of marriage, the ketubah, the kiddushin. That's not there. There is some debate halachically as to what is there and what is not there. The Rambam's view is that only a king is allowed to have a pilegesh. It's not something that can exist in halacha beyond the melech. And of course, the argument here would be that maybe his father was a leader of some kind, assuming that this was done legitimately, and assuming that, in fact, his mother was a Pilagesh. But but that's the relationship that's viewed here. V'nikreit zonah, so then why is she called a zonah? Lefi she'einan ba'ala b'ktuvah v'kidushin. Because she doesn't have all of the trappings of halachic marriage. V'hi kamo ha'zonah, it's like being a zonah, v'afal pishim yuchades lo, even though it's a monogamous relationship, even though she's only with him. I say monogamous, every time I say the word monogamous here, I realize that I'm cheating, because this is in the days of polygamy. Right, she is only with him, but he can have more than one wife. And in fact, we know he does. What?
Versus a zonah, who's with a lot of people.
With a lot of people, correct. So monogamous is not really the right word for it. Nonetheless.
On her end,
yes. No, but I think the correct term is monoandrous or something like that, technically.
You know what you meant.
Yes, okay. But that's the first approach. The first approach is that in fact, you know, he's the son of a Pilegesh, and the reason why this matters, the reason this is significant, is because if so, and the Radak talks about this, I didn't bring that piece in here, but if so, then his half-brothers are wrong for saying he doesn't get to inherit with us. Because the son born of a Pilegesh has full rights of inheritance along with everybody else. So they kicked him out inappropriately, and that feeds into the Chida's idea that really he had a leg to stand on legally, but he chose not to.
So why would they not marry the woman instead of making her a Pilegesh if the children anyway have the same...
Because it carries a financial burden. The ketubah, this whole requirement of various payments, comes with a regular marriage, doesn't apply in a Pilegesh situation. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's the first approach. V'Yonatan Tirgem, and then he says, Targum Yonatan, remember, the Gemara talks about Yonatan ben Uziel, Itana, from the Mishnah's time, as writing a sacred commentary / translation of Navi, and this is taken from that. Yonatan Tirgem Pundikita. Okay, a punak is a hotel or an inn. It's an innkeeper. Kamosha Tirgem Gamkin Rachav Azona Pundikita. Just like when we did the story of Rachav in the second parak in Yoshua, we also said that she was an innkeeper. Oh, alternatively, he offers you another idea. This is his third idea. Hu ha'inyan ba'atzmo. That's it in and of itself. Ki azona kmo apundakit shemafkeret atzma. He says, it's possible that what this really means is the traditional meaning of zona. And he uses the term pundakita because the two went together. In other words, the second approach is that she's actually an innkeeper. But if you say that she's an innkeeper, then it's hard to understand, because then, again, why doesn't he get to inherit? So then you get this other idea that, no, what it means is Zonah, who is available to everybody like the innkeeper is. And so that's another possibility. Within this view, taking this approach, the emphasis in the pasuk "Vayoled Gilad et Yiftach" is to say, despite the fact that she was not monogamous or monoandrous, nonetheless, we know who his father was. His father really was Gilad. He had a claim. Is the point?
Can I ask
yeah.
a bit of a question? Okay.
Yeah.
Here we are. A child is from the mother, and they're Jewish from the mother.
Yeah.
But they inherit from the father?
Yes. Because you have to keep in mind, how are you going to work tribal identity and with it the inheritance of land if you don't go by the father? You're living in a polygamous society. Man from Menashe, mm-hmm. right, marries a woman who's from Yehuda, mm-hmm. and marries a woman who's from Gad. Who has the land, and where does the land go among their children?
So, in this case, so what happens is the land goes to both of them, because the land is from the father. The
land goes to both of whom?
The children.
No, the man is Menashe.
Okay. Oh, the man is Menashe. Sorry.
It doesn't make a difference. Sorry. I'm just making it up. But let's say the man is Menashe, a wife is Gad, and mm-hmm. a wife is, some other Shevet, Yisachar.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
And they both have children.
And they have children.
Okay.
Right? Which Shevet do the children go with?
Oh, I see. Okay, so the children go with Menashe.
Yeah, just because there's only going to be one male in the household, but there can be more than one female. You create chaos otherwise.
It's chaos to begin. Sorry, it's just.
It's a tribal.
It never works. That's the other thing is we have yet to find a story in Tanakh in which polygamy is happy and successful.
Right.
Right. I mean, most people are familiar with the Chumash cases, but look at the ones you're seeing here. Right. These aren't any better. The reality is, the reason for allowing polygamy, we talked about this before, the reason for allowing polygamy is because the very first thing Hashem tells us he wants in the Chumash is produce children. And you maximize production of children if you don't limit the number of wives, as opposed to if you limited the number of husbands, right? In other words, if it can be more than one husband mm-hmm. to one wife, mm-hmm. then as long as she is pregnant and, nursing. No, as long as she's pregnant, nursing, whatever it is. All of these males are not producing children. They're all locked up, so to speak, with this one woman who is having whatever child.
I mean, it works as long as you have more women than men.
That's right. But if you don't have more women than men? Look at all the single women we have today.
But the women
right,
die.
Right, that's true. But it, generally speaking, did work.
And the women die.
Until today.
The women die.
The world population is 52% female.
We have 52% female today?
That's the world's population, yeah.
The men also die.
I thought it was more women than men. I thought it was 5%.
Yeah, historically it's
men.
Been. I understood it was 52 to 48, so it's roughly the same percentage you're saying.
Yeah. So a lot of the women die.
Yeah.
And the children died. So they had to.
But unfortunately, due to wars and due to everything else, you also have the men die.
It's just that, here we are, we're recognized as Jewish from the woman,
but the man controls
the land and the possessions.
That is biblical, yeah. And the question that's always asked is, when does it begin? Because it isn't before the Torah is given. Before the Torah is given, it's not so. But that's halachically we understand that's where the switch takes place. The conservative movement argues that it came from Ezra, but I think they're misreading Pesukim.
It's hard for us to understand because we're so used to a monogamous society that the idea of so many wives is horrendous.
It doesn't work well in Tanakh. The fact that it's allowed is because you don't want to limit procreation, but it does. It's not like we have any good stories in which everybody just got along and their kids got along and everybody was happy.
So what year was it that this
But I mean, it still happens in Amazon.
So Rabbeinu Gershom's official decree is 10th century Common Era. But already long before then, you don't see it. There's only one story I am familiar with that I can call to mind in the Gemara about somebody who's polygamous, and there he's not polygamous. It was the sage Rav who traveled to different cities, and they would identify a woman who would be his wife in the city, but they never actually lived together. There was never like the.
That's convenient, you know.
Yeah. Like in every city you travel to. You know?
But there wasn't. But again, there was no actual living together. We have laws of polygamy in the Gemara, but we don't have cases of polygamy, like actual Tanoim and Amoraim, sages who were polygamous. You know, it just doesn't work. That's the bottom line. It doesn't work.
And yet, it continued in other societies.
Yeah.
Today,
You had it. It started communities.
It works.
Yeah, I don't know.
It could be strange.
Okay, so that's all right. Going back to this discussion, so those are the first three explanations, and then the fourth, we have this added targum, and I don't know what he's quoting when he says this, but he says the targum shel tosefta, an added portion, says the following: Dahini Musa Havas biYisrael milakadmin. This was the practice in Israel in ancient times. Delomistachra achsanta mishivta l'shivta. That a portion should not go from one tribe to the other. Uvechein lahavayachil gavra lemesav itza delomishivta. And therefore, man was not allowed to marry a woman outside his tribe. What he's talking about is the story that occurs with the daughters of Tzlafchad. Because once the daughters of Tzlafchad, we are told, are able to inherit land, the rest of Menashe complains, right? They say, wait a minute, if they can inherit land, and then they get married, and inheritance in the family is going to go by the father, then Menashe's land is going to go with whoever they marry. So if they marry, if some woman from Menashe marries a man from Gad, and then they have kids, so all of her Menashe land is going to go over to the tribe of Gad. And that's a complaint that's found in Parshas Maaseh. And the response given there is, you're right. So therefore, women who inherit land should marry men from their own tribe in order to avoid this problem, in order to make sure this doesn't happen. So that's actually interesting. So they did, although the Gemara in Bava Basra says they didn't have to, that the daughters of Tzlafchad were exempt. They read the psukim to say the daughters of Tzlafchad are actually exempt from the rule, but they happened to find a shidduch in their shevet, in their tribe, so everybody went home happy. But that's what he says was the practice. The kad hava itisa derachma gavra delami shivtaha. And if a woman loved a man who was not from her tribe, havas nafka mi beinasha b'lo achsanta, then she would not get an inheritance. She couldn't take the land from her family. Vahavu inshi karun la, and people called her pundikisa derechimas garva delami shivtaha. They called her the innkeeper because she loved the man who was not of her tribe. She went after romance instead. Vechein havalele eme de yiftach, and that was the story with Yiftach's mother, according to this. Vidomeh, so he says, why did you need to say it? Like, where in the world did that idea come from? Why should that be what it means when it says zonah here? So he says, Vidomeh ki hitzrichu kol zeh lemetargem lefisha omar. Hitzrichu kol zeh lemetargem lefisha omar lo sincha beveis avinu ki venisha acheres ata. He says, the reason why the metargem renders this targum, this translation or commentary, the reason why he has to say that is because they say to him, you're not allowed to inherit in our father's house, you're the son of another woman. And it doesn't make any sense to say, you don't get to inherit because you're the son of another woman. That's not halachically true. So the answer is, what they were saying was, you don't get to inherit through your mother, because your mother was in this situation. You're not going to get an inheritance for that reason. That was the Yerusha, that was the inheritance issue that they were talking about.
But if a woman married within her shevet, then she got an inheritance from the land that they had, so it's still left
assuming that there were no sons, then she would be the one to inherit, correct?
So they would have to live on that land, but what about her husband who has his own land?
They could live on either one. They own both. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the family is still losing.
How?
They
own both pieces of land. Right. They choose to farm whatever they want. They could rent it out.
The husband also owns that land. It probably is very confusing then too. No?
What's the... Because the husband owns what he owns.
He's still losing land.
No. The family now has two portions of land within the Shevet. And when they have children, their children will inherit both pieces of land. And the Shevet is identified with all of them.
Okay.
In other words, Yehuda is the southern part of Israel, right? So it includes, let's say, Hebron, and it also includes parts of Yerushalayim, right? The split between Yehuda and Binyamin and Yerushalayim. So there's a woman who inherits land in Hebron, right? She's an only daughter, and she inherits land in Hebron. And she marries a man who's from Yerushalayim. So the two of them now have land in Hebron, and they have land in Yerushalayim. Mm-hmm. At some point they have children. They grow up. They get old. Eventually they pass on. Their children now have land in Hebron and Yerushalayim that's divided up in their estate.
So Yiftach's still stays in the Shevet.
Yeah.
Yiftach's brothers will inherit their mother's land and their father's land, and Yiftach will not inherit...
No, their mother doesn't have the land because she married out of her Shevet.
No, their mother. Not Yiftach's mother married out of her.
Oh, their mother.
Their mother, I'm assuming.
Their mother, we don't know, had any land whatsoever. We don't know if she had land or not.
You're saying this.
Right. So the statement is, but according to this read, when it says Lo Sinchal Beveis Avinu, it means Lo Sinchal, your mother's property, Beveis Avinu.
Oh.
Even though none of them are getting it. It's just a way to malign him. It's a way to mock him.
Oh, in other words, your mother didn't bring any property.
Yeah, something along those lines.
How do they know that who the true father of Yitzchak is? If she was an innkeeper?
The pasuk just says we know.
She was lived separately.
Right.
I know the term innkeeper is used as she's basically living.
Well, we don't know whether
separately. The answer is that the pasuk just says we know that his father was Gilad and that it wasn't challenged. Everybody accepted the paternity. That wasn't the question. Why? You'd have to have been there at the time to know how they knew. But they knew.
So, well, I accept that if there was no challenge, then, I mean, not that I have to accept, but there was some sort of...
They all accepted the paternity.
They accepted it.
Yeah, the challenge was not, he's not the father.
Okay, I understand.
No. One of the other elements that I think leads to the multiple interpretations of the word zonah here, mm-hmm. is the fact that when the brothers say this to him, when they say you're not inheriting, they say because your mother is, you are the son of another woman. Mm-hmm. Instead of using the pejorative zonah, they say the son of another woman, which I already said last week could be they were being polite because they're talking about their father here, mm-hmm. and they don't feel comfortable saying this about their father. But another explanation is because she wasn't a zonah in that sense. It was one of these other explanations. Now, again, we got to go back to the key question I asked last week, which is, who cares? Why did you need to tell me this about his mother? Like, what are you adding here with these kinds of details? With Rahav, we understood. It had to tell us Rahav was a zonah because it explained how she knew what she knew and why the spies went to her in the first place. If you remember the whole story then, we noted that it teaches us about Yericho, about the society there, that you have this person who, as the Gemara explained, was forced into that trade at the age of 10 and spends 40 years locked into that trade. That tells you something about the Canaanim. But here we have no such reference. We don't know anything about that. So I think one...
Isn't it a reflection on the brothers?
Meaning?
That they're rejecting him for this reason. I mean, maybe she was just the second wife, and
right.
they were jealous or whatever. They didn't like him, or they didn't like the wife.
Right.
And so it's a reflection on them, that they're right. throwing him out.
Right. So I think one reason could be, it's to show the brothers in,
really
you know, they rejected him. His mother was a Pelegish or whatever, and yet they rejected him. That would be one. The second would be that assuming the rejection was legitimate, in the sense that he doesn't inherit because there's really something that keeps the inheritance from happening, so it's explaining how this fight developed. because she was Zona, therefore he couldn't inherit, therefore he got sent out, and so on. But I think there might also be another element here. I wonder if the echo of Yericho isn't intentional. Right? Yericho was a degenerate society. The first individual we meet in Canaan is Rachav HaZona. That's our intro into Canaanite society. And here we go in this story, and we're doing it too. You know, it's to say another example of how we had become like the Canaanim among whom we lived. You think it was just Yericho that had it? No. We had it right here. So I wonder if that isn't another piece of it. So he gets evicted by his younger brothers, right? They kick him out. And he goes to the land of Tov. So what is the land of Tov? Well, in source number 3, I gave you a reference in Shmuel Bet, which you do not need to look up right now. The Dan Mikra notes that Tov is a place. We think of Eretz Tov. It's a good land, right? But Tov is a place, and it's invoked there in Shmuel Bet in the land of Aram. This area called Tov. So maybe he went to live in the place that was called Tov. That would be easy. However, despite the ease of it, Radak gives you a different explanation. Source number 4. Adon Haaretz Hayashimo Tov. The name of the master of the land was Tov. He went to live in the land of a guy named Tov.
It's like the Goel, they call him Tov.
Right. And that's actually brought here. He takes that view of the pasuk there, Im Yigalech Tov, yeah, if Tov will redeem you.
It's not
I don't know if it's not Pshat. Radak seems to think it is. And the truth of the matter is, it makes sense. Because the form, reading it in the other way, reading it as if he redeems you, good, is not a normal turn of phrase in Tanakh. You know, we don't have cases like that where someone says, if someone does this, Tov. You know, that's not, so I don't think it's so crazy. But that's Radak's take. And then Abarbanel offers me a different view. Abarbanel says in number 5, no, it was good land. Be'eretz Tova Rechava. Right? Good, spacious land. Umipnei Hayoso Be'eretz Tova Usveya. He's like too well Yiftach and Hashem Rekim Mibli Kesef Mibli Sahar. And he says that's why everybody banded around Yiftach, because Yiftach found some good land out away from the community, and all the other people who had nothing gravitated to Yiftach. So, you know, Abarbanel's advantage in this is he explains why the pasuk needs to tell me that he went to Eretz Tov, because otherwise, who cares? Right? If it's he went to the land of someone named Tov who I've never met and I'm never going to see again in Tanakh. You know, why did I need to know this? Unless you're going to tell me, since we don't know exactly when within Sefer Shoftim Rus takes place, it's the same Tov. The Tov here and the Tov, right, it's the Tov here and it's the Tov there. So maybe I do know who he is. So maybe.
Except Rut was written later, right?
Same
period. So meaning Rut was written later?
Why do you say that?
I'm asking.
No.
Because I was going to say, if it was written later, then at the time of writing this, there's no point in saying Tov.
Right, but it's not. But Shoftim and Rus are both written by Shmuel, as I recall. So he could actually be sitting there with two scrolls and saying, Tov.
Yeah, but they're contemporary, right? Well-known.
Yeah, and he would have been potentially a well-known person. He's a landowner. He was supposed to redeem Rus.
Where is Yitzhak? Is he after
that? Yitzhak is showing up in Perek Yevet.
Oh.
Yeah.
Could be.
So yeah, I wonder if that could be the same Tov. Tov is the one who's supposed to redeem her and doesn't.
Oh right, okay.
Yeah. So it's an interesting idea, that's for sure. But Barbanel, I think, is trying to answer the question of why did you mention that he's in Eretz Tov? The answer is no. This is part of the story. He finds good land, and therefore people gravitate. And the weakness of Abarbanel, of course, is that, as he writes in the beginning of his comment in number 5, it should be Tovaben.
Yeah.
The gender's wrong.
Yeah.
So, other than that, it's a nice idea.
Could it be in Israel still, according to Abarbanel?
So that's the other piece I'm going to get to.
Well, could it be like Eretz Tov, Eretz Shel Tov?
Yeah, but then it's a person, Tov. It's not Eretz, that is Tov.
And also, that it's, like you say, Yerushalayim Shel Zahav.
Right, but then you need a thing. Because Zahav is a thing.
In the sense of goodness.
But Zahav, but Tov isn't a noun. If you wanted to say it's a land of bounty, that would be an interesting way to do it, but I wouldn't write it this way. But there's another explanation, which is a bizarre explanation. And within everything we've said so far, this is land east of the Yarden in the general vicinity of Menashe's property. However, there's Yerushalmi, which I didn't bring you on the sheet, but you'll see it referenced shortly. The Yerushalmi in Shavias, as explained by the commentator, by the commentary Alei Tamar, says that what this Tov actually was a land that the Jews had not settled when they entered Israel under Yehoshua. There was a certain area that was technically within the boundaries, but they did not take the land. And so, and I guess it's not even under Yeshua, it's under Moshe, really, because this is east of the Yarden. And therefore, it was exempt from Truma and Maaser. Just like when we come back for the second Beis HaMikdash, there are certain properties that we don't settle in, and therefore they're exempt from Truma and Maaser. According to this Yerushalmi, there are cities that they don't take in this area called Tov, not cities necessarily, but there's land that they don't take. And therefore, it's exempt from tithing. And the residents there view it as tov, good, in the sense that they get to keep everything for themselves. There's no need for them to tithe it. It's actually technically outside. So go back to Rabbi Azulai in source number one, to the Chidah. And he explains, he's taking this view that that's where Yiftach went. And he explains why Yiftach would have gone there. Where at the end, if you're using the Hebrew, it's the end of the first line. If you're using the English, it's the middle of the second line. The Imaya Halech Le'eze Irme Eretz Yisrael, had he gone to a city in Israel, Hayim Echuyav La'alos L'Regel, he would have to go to Yerushalayim for Yom Tov. V'lecho Meiser Sheni B'Yerushalayim, when he had the secondary tithe, he would have to bring that to Yerushalayim to eat there. Umidei He'aloso, and in going there, Chash Shema Yavoli Hisgaros V'lachlo Gimzikne Ha'ir Ve'achav, he was worried that he would get into some kind of a fight. He'd meet the elders of his city, or he'd meet his brothers, and get into a fight with them. Lochein Barach L'chutz La'aretz, therefore he fled Israel. Shesham Eino Chayev La'alos L'Regel, where he would not be obligated to make Aliyah L'Regel, as is written in Tosus and Psach. I'll explain that in a minute. Upatur mimasros, and he'd be exempt from tithing, and therefore he wouldn't have to bring any tithes to Yerushalayim to eat there. So you wonder, like, why would he leave Israel? The answer is because he was trying to avoid strife. This is the way that the Chidah paints Yiftach. Yeah, he's a positive, good person. The Tosus is because there's a very interesting story. It's in the Gemara early on in Pesachim there. I gave you the reference, Gimel Amud Beis, about Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, that there was a non-Jew who used to brag that he used to go eat the Korban Pesach and that nobody ever caught him. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra says to him, did they give you from the tail fat? And he says, no, they didn't. He says, well, that's the best part. Clearly they're onto you. So he went back and he demanded the tail fat. And they knew instantly, he's not one of ours. The tail fat goes on the Mizbeach. It goes on the altar. So they investigated and they caught him as a result of that. And the Gemara concludes, as they praise Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra, who lives in Netzivim, but his net is spread as far as Yerushalayim. And the Tosfos asks, wait, why didn't he just tell them himself when he goes for Aliyah L'Regel? Why does he need to, come on? It's a neat trick, but like, what was the game about? So the answer is he didn't go for Aliyah L'Regel. And there are various explanations that are offered for why he didn't go. Maybe he was elderly, but one of the explanations is that he lived outside of Eretz Yisrael, and the mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel is only if you're in Israel, which is controversial, but that's what Tosfos says. So that's what the Chidah is referring to here. The Chidah is a fascinating read, and always worthwhile. It's just, adds a whole other dimension. He's 17th into 18th century, I believe. He's in Turkey, if I remember correctly. Turkey / Israel, actually, I believe. He wrote halachically, and he also wrote on drash, and as you see here on Navi, really one of these really remarkable figures who are very worth being familiar with. So we have all these different explanations for where it was that he lived, and again, if you take the view that it's just some guy named Tov, or it's some place Tov, it doesn't really add much to the story. However, if you take the view that this was the fellow who was from the story of Rus, so maybe it's mentioned because he's famous. If you take the view that it's good land and that's why people come to him, so it's a plot element. And if you take the view that it's that he left Israel to avoid a fight, then also it's a plot element. Okay. So we were told that Rekim gathers to him, right? Anashim Rekim Pochazim. We have these people who are empty people. Anashim Rekim who came to him, right? Empties. So we have, in general, in Tanakh, two models of empty people. I mentioned it already last time, but just to flesh it out a little bit more. You have people who are empty of social status. It doesn't say anything about who they are, but they don't have standing in society. And then you have people who are empty of character. Right. I referred last time to the first bullet point in number 6, where you had empties who came to Avimelech, right? The people who he hired to go kill his brothers. You have the people who gathered to David HaMelech, who are described as being empty as well. And then you have the empties who gathered to Yeravam. So we would like to assume that the Yeravam Avimelech variety are the people who have bad character, whereas the ones with David are just people who don't have social standing, like David is forced to flee from Shaul. So these are people who are also in trouble for one reason or another. The term is also used, Anashim Rekim, in Mishlei, in two cases which I brought you in the second bullet point, where it contrasts people who are productive farmers with people who are Rekim, who are empty. So these are people who don't contribute anything to society. It would sort of be the negative kind of Rekim. On the other hand, the last reference I gave you there is when somebody accused somebody else of being like one of the Rekim, based on where it is in Shmuel Bet. Somebody accused somebody else of being like one of the Rekim. You're going to be upset. You know it. Michal accuses David of dancing like one of the Rekim in front of the Aron. So, you know, there again, she's accusing him of being like one of these empty people. Yeah. So, it's an interesting thing, this phrase, Rekim, that's used. Well, this group that gathers to Yiftach, either you take a Barbanel's group and they're living off of the good land that he's found, or alternatively, they go looking for trouble, and that's Ralbag's view in number 7. V'yedmeshe Yiftach hayamanigam. It appears that Yiftach was their leader. V'ayu holchim l'milchamat tamid. They went to war continually, umisham chafru ochlam, and that's where they got their food. The machbor doesn't have to mean to dig. It can also be to purchase. They're not purchasing here. They're just getting their food. That fits, by the way. Ralbag is not just making it up when he says they went to war. He says vayetzu with him. And vayetzu is often a term for going to war. It also makes sense because they get a reputation as people who are tough. Okay, so our opening psukim here have introduced us to Yiftach as an outcast who may be of good character, may not be of good character, but he's kicked out and told, you're not going to inherit. He has to go to this Eretz Tov, whatever that is. And he gets a group of people who are probably people of poor character. And either they hang out and just live off of the land there, or worse, they're ruffians and they attack people in order to survive. And then we get to the turnaround in the story, where suddenly the community needs Yiftach. So take a look at what happens here. We're going to read Psukim Dalet Tzid Aleph, sentences 4 to 11. Actually, we'll do 4 to 6 first. Vayimi Amim. It was after some time. Vayilachamu b'nei Amonim Yisrael. Amon went to war with Israel. All right, and again, this is either a continuation from the end of the 10th chapter, meaning the war they were going to do then is now being told. We just had an interlude where we gave Yiftach's backstory. Or alternatively, that war was diffused. Hashem said, I don't want there to be a war now. The Jews have done tshuva. And then this is happening sometime later. Either way. Vayikasher nilchamu v'nei Amonim Yisrael. It was when Amon went to fight with Israel. Vayelchuzik nei Gilad lakachas es Yiftach me'eretz tov. The elders of Gilad went to get Yiftach from Eretz Tov. Now, if I weren't biased against Yiftach because I know his daughter's story, I would think this was wonderful. Right? This is rags to riches. Right? Here you have a guy who everybody rejected, right? I mean, it's like David HaMelech, right? Eben Masua Bonim Haisalar Osh Pina, the stone that everybody rejected is suddenly the cornerstone. Everybody's going to turn to him and say, save us in war. You know, it's the brothers coming back to Yosef and saying, feed our family. It's, you know, it's Moshe who had to flee. It's our greatest heroes, right? Society kicked them out, rejected them, they were harsh to them. And lo and behold, look at what they became. Yitzchak, right? Avimelech comes to Yitzchak and says, let's make a deal. And Yitzchak says, you kicked me out. Right? You kicked me out of Grar. Now you want me back? Now that's what's happening here with Yiftach. If not for the fact that, you know, I don't think he's such a wonderful person. I would say this just fit right along the line with all of our other heroes. But I think this may be the more realistic version, in the sense that sometimes there's a reason why somebody is an outcast. Right? It's not just like everybody were horrible people and they were mean to somebody and then they needed him. Yiftach may be on the outs for a reason, not because of his mother. Not talking about that issue, but the issue of what comes to light in the course of the next chapter and a half. You know, it's not random. This is something to think about in terms of these kinds of rags to riches stories. Okay. Vayamru liYiftach, they said to Yiftach, Lecha v'ayisa lanu likatsin. Go be a katsin for us, v'nilachama bivnei Amon. And we're going to go fight against Amon. What's a katsin?
Officer. Chief.
Everyone has officer?
Chief.
Chief officer.
No.
Okay. Keep that word in mind, please. Let's actually go further with it, because it doesn't make sense to pause here. Svara, position of authority. Okay. Be a katsin for us. Vayoma Yiftach lezikne Gilad. So Yiftach says to the elders of Gilad, Halo atem sinei semosi, you hate me. Vatagarshuni mi beis avi, and you kick me out of my father's house. He uses almost the same language as Yitzchak uses with Avimelech. You hated me. You kicked me out of my father's house. Umadua basem elai ata. So why are you coming to me now? Kasher tsar lochem, when you're in trouble. You know, he says, what are you kidding? I'm doing fine. I'm in Eretz Tov. Thanks. You know, go deal with Amon. Vayomaru ziknei Gilad el Yiftach, and the elders of Gilad say to Yiftach, Lachein atah shavnu elecha. Therefore, we have now returned to you. Valachta imanu, you're going to go with us. V'nilchamta v'vnei Amon, you're going to fight Amon. V'yisalanu l'rosh l'chol yoshvei Gilad, and you're going to be the head of all of the dwellers of Gilad. Isn't that going to be cool? Vayomer Yiftach el ziknei Gilad. So Yiftach says back to them, "In mishivim atem osili hilachem b'vnei Amon. If you bring me back to fight with Amon, the nasan Hashem osam lefanai, and God gives them into my hands. Anochi ayelachem l'rosh. I will be your head." Terms accepted, very much so. Except not, as you'll see. Vayomru ziknei Gilad el Yiftach, and the people of Gilad say to Yiftach, Hashem yehye shomea beinoseinu im lo chidvarcha kein nase. The elders of Gilad say to Yiftach, God will hear between us if we don't do as you said. In other words, it's an oath. Right? By God. They're swearing that they're going to do this. Vayelach Yiftach im ziknei Gilad. Yiftach goes with Gilad, with the elders. Vayasimu ha'amo so aleihem l'roshu l'katzin. They make him Rosh and Katzin. Vayidaber Yiftach has called the Varav lifnei Hashem ba'mitzvah. And Yiftach says all of this, which the Mefarshim, the commentators say, means, states the deal between them, lifnei Hashem, in front of God, ba'mitzvah, in mitzvah. What questions do you have as you read this? There are some things you should be asking. What's strange here?
Well, right.
So Ralbag is going to say that that's the point of talking about how he gains this rough and tumble guys out in the wilderness. He has a reputation for violence. He's just the type of ruffian we need.
I mean, unless you're saying that these men just didn't have money so they came, it doesn't have to mean that they were violent, right?
Well, that's the question of what were they doing to make their living, and that was the idea that they're not just, you know, farming in the land or living off of good land. They're actually raiding things. Yeah, if you go back to what we had said in number 7 from Ralbad, that's Ralbad's position. But what here in the language doesn't work? There are a couple of things.
I'm not really understanding when he says, you know, if I win the battle, then I'll become your leader, and then they say to him, okay, you know, we're swearing for Hashem that we'll go bring what word? Like, I don't understand what they're offering him. Like,
that he could be their leader.
No, like, is, are they saying, okay, if God doesn't save you, then you're not going to be our leader, but if God, you know, so...
Well, that's his words. They didn't say that. They didn't put God into the sentence at all.
Oh, it says, yeah.
They said that Hashem should be right? His test.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and then they go on to Mitzpeh, and they swear it down in Mitzpeh then? Like, he says it there, and then...
So one question is, what's this Mitzpah thing? Like, why are they going to Mitzpah? What's the...
Isn't that where the...
Shiloh is where the Mishkan is. Shiloh's not there.
Oh, yeah, so why...
What do they mean, in front of God in Mitzpah? That's one question. Another question. When they say to him, therefore, right? He says... They say to him, we want you to be the Katzin. He says to them... But you kicked me out, now you want me. And they say, therefore, we've come to you and asked you whatever. What's the therefore? Yeah.
But his brothers kicked him out. The people who came with him are the guys that he attracted.
Yeah, so apparently he lumps them all together because they didn't stop his brothers. If you think of like Kamsa Bar Kamsa, right, that story?
Yeah.
He says, if the hosts, the anonymous host in that story, can kick me out of the party, and all the elders are sitting there and they don't say anything, obviously they're good with it. It's Kamsa Bar Kamsa.
Right. What is the reason that they're asking
them?
I'm not explaining the reason.
Well, I'm asking, no, what is there there? What does the word therefore mean there? Therefore, in other words, because of X, therefore Y. X presumably is because we kicked you out. Because we kicked you out, therefore, what?
Well, according to here, it says because we have wronged you.
Right, because we wronged you, therefore what?
Is it like a consolation prize?
We want you to be a leader now. We
feel best.
Is that a winning argument?
We want you to go to battle now, Frank.
He says to them, you think I'm going to lead you now after you were terrible to me? And they say, because we were terrible to you, that's why we've asked you to be our leader in the war against Amon.
No, he says, now we realize we made a mistake.
It's not that we realize we made a mistake. Because we did this, therefore something. Nanette, what were you going to say?
He said, it's Sarlat, I'm like, it's difficult for you, and that's it. Yeah, that's why we came to get you.
No, but it's difficult meaning you're facing Amon.
Do they see Amon, the fact that Amon is fighting them, that's a punishment for them?
It would be ironic if they would view it as punishment for what they did to him, as opposed to the fact that they've been worshipping all these 7 idolatries, mm-hmm. for which they've been directly rebuked.
Oh, I have another question.
Yeah.
Okay. I hope I'm understanding this right. So basically, they're offering him the position of leader, to which he replies, if Hashem makes me successful, then I'll be your leader. But they already offered him the position. Why does he need, if Hashem makes me successful? They're already giving him the position of leader. Why is it contingent on...
I think that's actually a big point, is that he introduces God into this statement. They did not. He did. He said, if Hashem makes me succeed, then I will. But I think part of it also is because you have to watch the sleight of hand in terms of what's being offered. What are they offering him at different stages? It's not all one offer. Their first offer, we said, was Katzin.
Oh, not leader, Katzin.
Right.
Not a Shafet.
The first offer was Katzin.
And he says, Rush.
He said, who are you kidding? You want to come back to me? And therefore, in Pasuk Ches, in sentence 8, they give him a second offer. We're going to make you a Rosh. We're not just going to make you Kazin. They have no middle ground, apparently. It's not like, yeah, we kicked you out, so come back and be a citizen. No. We're going to bring you in, and you're going to be, we're going to elect you our leader now. All of Yoshevei Gilad are going to recognize you as that.
Aren't officers in the most dangerous positions in war?
Yeah.
So if they don't like him very much and they kick him out, they're like, let's get this guy to be at the front of the battle line.
Right, well, that's what it could have been, as the Katsin, until they said Rosh. That could have, for all we know, Katsin is the cannon fodder. It's all well and good, and they give you a title.
Katsin is a military term, whereas Rosh is a political term.
Very much so. Let's go through this. I think I've beaten the questions to death. Let's see what we can do with the answers. So, again, they go to Yiftach. The fact that they think of Yiftach speaks to the success that he has had. And the fact that they're not embarrassed to seek his help speaks either to the Dat Mikra's point that this was sort of standard operating procedure, that you would go to the ruffians in a time of war, hire them, they're your mercenaries, and then send them back home. And so they thought they would do that again. That was the Dat Mikra idea. And by the way, Amon did the same thing when they went to war against David in Shmuel Bet. In Perek Yud, it's chapter 10 in Shmuel Bet, Amon does the same exact thing when they're fighting David. They go to gather people who are on the outs in order to fight against David in particular. Mm-hmm. Or it speaks to the desperation of their situation. Right? In other words, maybe this wasn't the normal thing to do, but they just like, what else are we going to do? We don't have any way to fight Amon. If you take a look at source number 8, Ralbag, with another one of his practical lessons that you can learn from these stories. Hasheni, the second lesson he draws from the story, is that it's a bad idea to pursue people who are weak just because they lack support at the gate. The gate being the place where everybody, where the decisions are made of the council. Hello, Tirem Ashakar Lezikne Gilad. Look what happened to the leaders of Gilad, right? They ended up having to go back to Yiftach. So he says, don't take advantage of the vulnerable. You never know what's going to happen. Very pragmatic type of, remember his lesson about Avimelech. Don't stand next to the tower when you're, So they go to Yiftach and they make him this offer. Take a look at Malbim in number 9. Malbim says, this is what a katsin is. He says, a katsin hu ha'omed b'ktzei ha'machaneh. Katsin, from the words, kates or katseh, the end, the edge. He stands at the edge of the camp. Machmas chashivuso u'ma'alaso b'gvura ba'osher b'chachma. Because of his importance and his status, it's a function of strength, wealth, wisdom, whatever. Hagam she'eno rosh u'moshel aleihem. He's not the head, he's not the ruler. That's what they initially say. We need you as a fighter. We'll give you a position of honor in the camp, and that's what they're recruiting him for. But I want you to go back for a second to Perek Yud, chapter 10, sentence 18. The last sentence in chapter 10, when they're first facing a war with Amon, and they ask themselves, who is it who's going to lead us? They said, who will fight Amon? Whoever will fight is going to be our political leader. Right? Now they go to Gidon and they don't offer him political leader. They say, you can be a big soldier. So maybe that's why he turns around and says, I know, I can sweeten this deal. Like, I can get a better deal than just to be an officer. So, one note here before we go a little further. Is military success what we seek normally in a military leader in Tanakh? Classically, if you look through Tanakh, we associate military success with righteousness as opposed to strength or training. Right? Abraham and the four kings, the brothers of Yosef in Egypt. Shimon and Levi have a reputation as being mighty. But the Psukim don't tell us that. We just know that Shem was vulnerable and they attacked. Moshe with Sichon and Og, God will help them in order to win in their battle. I brought you the Midrash number 10 that Moshe picks Yoshua to fight the war with Amalek, not because Yoshua is an experienced and great military leader, but he wants Yoshua to get some experience. According to this Midrash, Moshe knows already before the Torah is given that he's not leading the Jews into the land, which is difficult, but the Midrash can do things like that. But here, in our discussion, they're not picking him because of righteousness. That seems fairly clear, even if I take the view that he's wonderful. They're picking him because they can see that he is strong. If you look at number 11, I brought you Ralbag, who says that it was clear to them that he was militarily successful because he was a raider. That was what he was doing all this time in Eretz Tov. So they come to him and they say, We want you to lead us. We want somebody with strength. This is the kind of person we need to be our warrior. And he says, sorry, no thanks. And they say, all right, we'll make you our political leader. You will be our shofet. Because you're mighty, we're going to make you into our shofet. And he turns to them, right, saying, by the way, you were the ones who did this to me. That was what we saw in Pasuk Zion. And forces them to say Rosh. And here, we get to the Lachain, to the therefore that's in sentence 8. Therefore, because we sent you away, according to that Mikra and Malvim, therefore we will make you the leader on an ongoing basis. That's one read. The second read is, if you look closely at the sentence, Lachain atashavnu elecha. Abarbanel Mitzudat David float this idea. Therefore, we are coming back to you instead of summoning you to us. Meaning, if we had not wronged you before, it would be appropriate for us as the council of the Jews of this area to say to you, come to us, we would like you to do something on behalf of the nation. But because we messed up, therefore, we are coming to you with this request, and it fits the language nicely in the psukim. To which Yiftach says back to them what sounds like a restatement of the case in pasuk tet in sentence 9. He says, "Okay, so these are the terms: you bring me back, and God will make me succeed. Then I will be your leader." Abarbanel says it's stronger than that. It's in number 12 on your sheet, but because we're getting late, I'm going to just sum it up. He says, no, you're not honoring me. You better believe that I'll be your leader if I win this war. Because that's the way it works. How can I not rule over you? Abarbanel says that it's a kind of in-your-face response to them. Of course I'm going to be the leader. But I wonder if he isn't adding, when he throws in that clause, if Hashem helps me to succeed, especially if I take the second view, the view that he's righteous. You know, he's giving them a little bit of a lesson here. If Hashem helps me succeed, and we know that's part of his identity, because that's what's going to get him into trouble at the end of the parak, when he's going to say, if God makes me succeed, I'll give whatever comes out of my house. Like, this is part of his identity. There's an element almost of foreshadowing here. But then, I will be your leader. So the people, in Pasuk Yud, in sentence 10, the people say, God will be our witness. Right? This is a classic oath. But Abarbanel says it's not just the classic oath. Abarbanel said that his response was, of course I'll be your leader. So their point to him is, no, we will willingly accept you as leader. Kainah said, this is what we are willing to do, which is why, look at Pasuk Yud Aleph more closely, they went with him and they made him a Rosh and a Katsin, but the war hasn't happened yet. They make him a Rosh before the war. So that demonstrates that they're accepting what he said willingly. Abarbanel says it. I wrote it in for you in number 13. That they choose to accept him sight unseen, so to speak. He hasn't, even though he hasn't won anything. And then Yiftach repeats the terms in Mitzvah. Before God and Mitzvah. We could take another 1 minute just on that point, on the before God and Mitzvah, because I don't want to come back to this at the start next time. The consensus of commentators is that Yiftach is repeating the terms of the agreement. But what's special about Mitzvah? So one view, Dat Mikra, Radak, they suggest that Yiftach made his home in Mitzvah. Because later on, you'll see it in Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Lamed Daled, in sentence 34. We'll see that Yiftach's home is in Mitzpah. Although it seems like he's also goes back to Tov at one point to prepare for the war. It's not quite clear. Yeah, the cottage. So that's his home. That's one view. Second view is from Rashi and Mitzudat David, and that was that the Jews gathered here back in chapter 10, sentence 17. Right? They gathered in Mitzpah back then, and so therefore Hashem is present there. It's the thing Hashem in Mitzpah. Hashem's there in Mitzpah because it's a place where we gathered. Once Jews gather in a location that gives it sanctity, that gives it Kedusha, that gives it holiness.
Are they still camped there?
So it seems like even though they're not still camped there, I believe, that this is not necessarily right after that gathering, although it would depend a little bit on whether I view this war as the same war or a future war. But Rashi doesn't specify. And then the third idea is that Radak says Mitzpah is a place where God has been present for a very long time. In Yehoshua chapter 11, the Jews fought the amassed armies of Yavin, king of Canaan. Right, we talked about that way back when. In Mitzpah. And we had this miraculous victory. And so, according to Radak, and I brought it for you on the sheet in number 15, ever since, that was a place we went to daven. That was a place we went to pray, because it was where we had had this great victory that Hashem gave us. So therefore, now as we prepare for this war, we're back here again. That's Radak. Rabak brings it as well. So to summarize here what we've said and the key point, we see here that they come back to him. He drives a hard bargain. I'm not just going to be an officer. I'm going to be a political leader. They say, okay, you're going to be a political leader. If you take Abarbanel's read, he says, well, of course I'm going to be the leader. What choice do you have? And they say, no, willingly, even before the war, we will make you into our leader. But there's another element here, and this goes back to what Ora was saying. And this is the point that Professor Rosenson was trying to make when we read him in chapter 10. Gideon did not pursue power. Right? The people came to Gideon after the war and said, we want you to be our leader. And he said, God is your leader. Maybe he accepted it, maybe he didn't accept it, but it's clear that he certainly did not pursue it. Avimelech pursued power and led with violence. Tola learned from what happened with Avimelech, and we saw him as a righteous shofet. He's vayishvot, he judges people, he's good. But then Yair, right after that, puts all this emphasis on wealth and status and his children with their animals and their cities and the whole bit. And now we see Yiftach go that route, demanding authority. It's going back to the Avimelech model, not having learned that lesson. And here we see the demanding of power, and then we'll see as we go into chapter 12, the violence as well. So this is a mess. We haven't learned the lessons that we were meant to learn. So we'll see where this goes in the rest of this chapter, God willing, next week.
Yiftach is coming from anger, resentment of how he was treated before.
Yeah. So I, it would certainly be.